Hi, this is Danielle from The Jealous Curator, and this is episode 69 of Art for Your Ear. This episode is supported by Saatchi Art, the world's largest curated online gallery offering original art by independent artists from around the world. Pop over and check out their huge lineup of artists at saatchiart.com. Today is going to be a little bit sassy and a whole lot of Canadian. Yep, two Canadians talking about pinup girls and old comic books. Should be interesting. I wrote about Ryan Heschka's gorgeous vintage-inspired paintings after Martha Rich introduced me to his work in the summer of 2015. She thought I would love him, and boy, was she right. Ryan and I both lived in Vancouver at the same time, but somehow our paths never crossed until today. So here we go, calling Ryan in Vancouver. How are you?
Good. Oh, this sounds really clear.
Yes, it does.
Okay, awesome.
Must be our Canadian connection.
Yeah, and as soon as you cross the border, it goes all wonky and everything.
That's right.
Yeah.
How's it going over there?
It's good. Yeah.
Do you have a sleeping baby nearby?
She's out for a walk.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, so my wife took her out for a walk, and I closed the door, so even if they come home, it should be fine.
But, okay. How old is she?
She is going to be 3 months next Saturday.
Oh, my gosh. Teeny tiny.
Yeah, pretty. Yeah, well, she's, I think, big for her age, though. But, yeah, still, like, you know, 14 pounds, basically. So.
Well, tinier than my 10-year-old.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Well, yeah, hopefully.
Hopefully, yeah.
This is really weird because I just see your husband's face staring at me with your voice, so.
I know, I get that a lot. I really should.
It's real. You know what? Maybe I'll just put a post-it note. It's really distracting. No offense to your husband. Oh, that's better.
There. Yeah.
It's just weird. You know, I find the whole Skype thing sort of weird with the faces and voices. I'm so old school. I don't even like to talk on the telephone.
Me either.
So I find Skype with the diverted eye contact thing, you know, with the video is so weird.
I know. I'm not a fan of really talking to people, to be honest.
Yeah.
I don't even order pizza.
Yeah, exactly.
I make my husband do it. And so that's why when he was like, you should do a podcast, I was like, what? And phone people all the time on Skype.
Yeah.
And I secretly, this is terrible, but I always secretly hope that people will cancel on me. And then after the call, I am always like, so like jazzed up and like, that was so much fun. Who else can I call? And then the next time I get all anxious again.
Yeah, I have a little bit of anxiety, but nothing worth talking about. But it's just this. I've only done one other podcast, and it was fun. It was with Ink Studs, but it was like I was a little bit nervous going into that one too. So
I was going to ask you that if you're a super interview pro.
No, not at all. Mm. Not at all.
Well, I would think with your work, everybody would want to interview you.
Well, thank you. I'll take that as a compliment. Yeah, no, I haven't. You know what? I'm a terrible self-marketer too. So I think if I wanted to push that, I could. I have been turning down a few different sort of interviews and stuff for online magazines and blogs and things just because of the baby and that. So,
yeah,
you know, I've been kind of a little bit shut down, with the baby thing. And well, maybe we're talking too much. Is the podcast started or are we just blabbing and wasting time?
We're blabbing, but you know, it starts recording as soon as I call you, so I'm just keeping this in. Let's just blab away.
Okay, yeah, that's a good way to start.
Yeah.
But anyways, yeah, since the baby's arrived, it's sort of, you know, the priorities have been the sleeping, taking care of the baby, eating, and then getting back to painting, and that's it. Like I'm turning down so much stuff and shutting down things that I normally would do on a day-to-day basis, and it's all sort of shifted for me. So
yeah. And so did you take a chunk of time, like, are you painting again now, or did you just take a chunk of time off?
I took about a month off, about 3 weeks to a month off, and then sort of eased back into it, which was a pretty slow ease in. And I always knew it would be like this, and I'm 45, so I'm an older dad, and I always sort of knew it'd be really difficult, and I'd have to put my art on hold for a brief period and stuff. And I'm selfishly, I never wanted to do that.
Yeah.
So, but finally we just jumped in, but it is sort of a difficult, transition to do the, to put the painting on hold and then sort of get back into it. And I'm also in the middle of doing a bunch of very large commissions that I've never done. I've never really done a lot of large work. So there's sort of the added pressure to translate my work into larger pieces while sleep deprived and looking after a new human being.
Oh, yeah. That's a lot of stuff.
Yeah. So, I really wanted to do the podcast with you because I know you you have a good roster of people that you've done interviews with. So,
well, I know, and it's so funny because we really should know each other.
Yeah.
You'd think that we would. And so I was going to ask you, okay, we're going to get to the real questions in a minute, but
you
know Martha Rich, right?
Yes.
How do you guys know each other?
I met Martha when we moved to LA in 2007 for about 2 years.
Okay.
Yeah. So we met, Martha and, Mark Todd and Esther Watson and brothers and a whole, I'm just name dropping here, but just made friends with a whole bunch of great people in LA basically. And Martha was one of them. And you know, once Martha's got her hooks into you, it's hard to get rid of her. I'm just kidding. Martha's great. We would never let Martha go.
I know. Me either. Martha was one of the first people I ever wrote about. And I mean, I didn't know her. I just loved her work. And then I just kept asking her to do stuff with me. And we've become really good friends. And I was just saying that she illustrated my new book. And I was just saying to my husband, like, if you had told me almost 8 years ago when I started the blog, I think she was probably the fourth or fifth person I wrote about, that we would now be friends. Mm. I just wouldn't have ever believed it. She's just so cool. And so, yeah, and she had told me about you, actually.
Okay, yeah, that's right. That's kind of through Instagram. I think that whole sort of, like, I guess I got on your radar through Martha and through
Instagram. Loved your work instantly. And then that's why I was like, how did I not know? I mean, I would lived in Vancouver for years. And so it's just so weird to me that we didn't really cross, but here we are today.
Yeah, well, two people that probably, you know, didn't like to talk to people.
Yeah,
so
or not, leave our house. Do you ever leave your house?
Not too surprising that we never met before.
That is an excellent point. That is an excellent point.
Martha is, I'm just going to toot Martha's horn one more time, but she's amazing.
Yeah, she is. I love her. I was going to ask, this is so not my normal thing. Normally I start off by getting your whole story. So we're going to go back and do that in a second, but I really want to talk about the baby for a second because I have so many women on all the time, same thing, that are around our age, like late 30s, early 40s, who've had their first baby and have to put their art practice on hold. And I did not know you guys were expecting. And then I just had somebody on last week who had a 4-month-old, and I just love that I was having a dad on for the first time instead of just a mom on. And I also really love that you took a break. Your wife must love you so much.
Yeah, you know, you gotta do what you can do to keep things happy in the household.
Yeah, no kidding.
I wanted to really sort of spend time and bond with the baby as well. I'm fortunate, back to the sort of backtracking a little bit to the big commissions. These big commissions that I've got came at a great time. They're almost sort of like serving as a bit of a mat leave, where there's sort of a chunk of financial, you know, cushion there that allowed me to sort of take a little bit of time off. And also allows for my wife to sort of take time off. And she's been great about letting me get back to work. My days used to be 12-hour days. Now I'm sort of like a seven-hour workday to me right now is a great workday. That's a good chunk of time, and I can get a lot done in 6 or 7 hours. But yeah, sort of there was a set understanding that we talked about for years before we got pregnant, and that was sort of that I would be able to sort of I would have to be in a position to sort of maintain the job side, and Miranda, my wife, would be able to sort of look after the baby. And then also having a flexible schedule. She's a dance teacher and a dancer by profession. So she would eventually get back into that, which is more of an evening job. So I would be able to take the baby in the evenings and sort of trade off down the road. So we're in some ways we're SOL because we have no mat leave and no sort of support that way. But also it's great because we're flexible enough in our schedules that we are able to not have to worry about daycare at this point.
Yeah.
And not have to shell out a whole bunch of money for childcare and stuff to go back to our jobs. and somehow, you know, hopefully remain afloat. I mean, things are still early on, but it's been good so far.
And that's good. Like, I think the flexibility thing, that's how my husband and I were. And, you know, you figure it out. And there's days when you're like, oh, boy. And then it somehow miraculously works out.
Yeah.
Is your studio in your house then, or do you leave?
No, it's in my house. So that's another good thing about with the baby. Well, good and bad. I mean, great that I'm always there to help or take the, you know, I shouldn't just call her baby. Her name is Roxy. Her name is baby. So.
Oh, what a great name. Oh, I love it.
Thank you. Yeah. So anyways, I can take Roxy off of her hands if she needs to go do something. At the same time, it can be very distracting, but I'm trying really hard to just, like I said, put the music on, work for 6 to 7 hours a day, and just like paint solid. And if I can get 6 or 7 solid hours of painting in a day, that's a great day. That's all I ever was able to get in before anyways, because I think you have sort of I have a painting burnout, you know.
Yeah.
I can only go so far with it, and then I'm like, I need to take a break, or, you know, and then that's usually when I get on the internet and surf the internet for 2 hours. Or
yeah.
Something,
which I was no longer
really do that anymore. So I had sort of a section of time that I was able to just cut out and not miss a beat too much. So.
Yeah. Well, I was talking to an artist from Australia last week that has the new baby, and she said the same thing. She's like, you know, I only have these chunks of time. And she said, before the baby, I would have been like, I'll just make a cup of tea first and maybe I'll surf around. And she's like, now it's like, okay, go, because you've got this chunk of time.
It's kind of good. It kind of actually makes me, I keep saying but it's like, I'm not, I shouldn't speak for everybody, but it makes me, really concentrate, really focus, and really think about what's important. And really, when I put, you know, speaking professionally now, when I put like, color down, or when I put a brush to the paper or something, I want to make it count. There's sort of a pressure there to really, like, you know, I let myself make mistakes in that, but at the same time, it's like everything I do now is sort of has a purpose versus just sort of noodling around, or, you know,
yeah,
that sort of thing. So it's there's a lot more sort of jumping right into things, and that's just by necessity.
Mm-hmm. I love it. It might even change the way you work. Who knows?
It could.
Yeah.
I think it already has, because I'm definitely sort of, I guess when I started, I really was doing a lot of little paintings and a lot of little illustrations. And I think that's sort of a natural approach. You sort of take on small things. And I've always liked to micro paint. I always liked small drawings and small things, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think now with the baby and the timing of everything, it's like, now I'm sort of into these large commissions for some private collectors.
How big is large?
Like the one I have right now is about 2 meters by 1.7 meters,
what?
I guess. Yeah. So they're like, it's a big leap. And I don't want to talk too much about that. That's still sort of a project in progress. And there's some other things down the road that will happen with that, but I want to jinx it, actually.
I don't want to blurt it out. Okay, no problem.
Anyway, so I'm kind of like, I've got the large commissions. I've just started sort of nailing down a plot. And again, I don't want to jump the gun on this, but I think things are looking pretty good for a Mean Girls Club number 2.
Oh, yeah.
An extended sort of extended book project. So there's that big sort of chunk. And what was the third? There's a third thing, and my baby-addled brain can't think of even what that third that third major thing is. But
No pressure. Yeah. No, you probably haven't slept
in the front right now.
Yeah, you haven't slept properly.
Basically, what I'm getting at is, in a long-winded way, is that I've sort of whittled projects down to only the sort of the largest or the most personal or the most important to me. And I've sort of let a lot of little painting go by the wayside. I don't do a lot of illustration work anymore. I don't do a lot of sort of small paintings. Everything's sort of really distilled down at this point.
Mm-hmm. That's so interesting. Okay, well, let's go back and talk about the small paintings. So let's actually talk about when you were small. I want to know... Okay, this is really funny. You grew up in Manitoba.
Yes.
I lived in Morden for a summer.
Okay, for a summer.
My parents lived there and when I was in university, so I'd go back in the summers and at Christmas and stuff. So you were in Brandon, right? And then Winnipeg?
Yes. Yeah. Winnipeg okay. was like four onwards to
the oh, okay.
early 20s. Yeah.
So, we'll discuss Corn and Apple Festival later, but, so when you were little, were you like in love with comics and drawing your own comics or like, what were you, that's my guess from your portfolio now, but what were you like?
That's a really good guess. I think you can pretty much imagine. If you just imagine a little kid with a bowl cut and doing all those kind of things that you're imagining, that's exactly who I was when I was a kid. Yeah. Like as early as I can remember, I was copying panels out of Batman comics and making my own, comics. If you want, I can actually send you some children's art just for the blog. I think it's more interesting than a lot of the new stuff I do sometimes. Cause it's just, I love kids art and it's so much fun. And I have sort of an envelope full of kids art that I sort of edited down and kept with me when I move around and stuff like that.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
And I just loved all that. I loved Batman. I loved, comic books and monster movies. And, it was always a big deal when King Kong came on Sunday afternoon. Cause there was no video way to videotape it or anything like that. So it was sort of like a Halley's Comet sighting. It was like King Kong's going to be on. Oh my God. you have to be home for this, you know? So
do you have siblings?
I have a brother, yeah, younger brother.
Was he artsy too, or was this your thing?
Yeah, no, we made comics together, and, you know, we were both sort of into monster movies, and we made, like, stop-motion Super 8 movies together. We did our own thing, but we also sort of did these sort of group things as well from time to time, so.
That's so cool. And so did you think that you would be an artist when you grew up? Was that your plan?
No, I never even knew that was an option. I thought that was just something you did for fun.
Yeah.
And I think I kind of had that mentality right up until like well into my 20s, until I sort of really started meeting people that were doing art for a living or design and that. And it's like, oh, like I never, you know, in Winnipeg, I was never really exposed to any artists or people that drew or anything like that. So not a lot, maybe the occasional one or something, but it never really seemed like an option to make a living out of.
So what did you think you were going to do?
I just sort of went along. I never really had a sort of like, I'm going to do this when I grow up or anything. And I think, as you know, and some people might not know, but I went to school for interior design and graduated with a Bachelor of Interior Design from the University of Manitoba. And I think that I sort of was trying to apply creativity to something that seemed practical.
Yeah.
So interior design, I had an uncle that actually did interior design. That was sort of my, I guess, inroad. I'd spoken to him and that sort of thing. So, but yeah, eventually, you know, I won't get into all the details in between, but eventually I started to meet artists and designers and stuff and really sort of got back to what I loved to do when I was a kid. And that is just drawing and making comics and painting and that. And it sort of really took root, I guess, after I left interior design to sort of, I knew that I wanted to sort of pursue illustration. After living in Toronto for a while, I was sort of exposed to more and realized that I was sort of on the wrong career path. Mm-hmm. I really just got back into all the things I loved as a kid. And I never really let that go. I mean, to this day, I'm still like today I'm painting airplanes and dinosaurs, you know,
yeah.
And it's just, it's maybe a little bit better now, maybe not quite as dynamic as when I was a kid, maybe a little more studied, but, it's just, I think I sort of like fought the current a long time. And then eventually when I gave in, it really sort of took me with it. And it was the right sort of, it felt right at that point.
That's so great. And so that was in your 20s?
That was in my, mid-20s to late-20s. I sort of was trying to figure out illustration and art at that point.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, I got into sort of another career, which was sort of animation, doing animation cleanup and that sort of thing when I moved to Vancouver.
Mm. And so when were you in Toronto?
92 to 94.
Oh, I showed up in 96.
Okay.
I went out to Toronto for about 10 years, so we just missed each other.
Okay.
And then you went to Vancouver.
And then, yeah, a little stint back at Winnipeg to sort of regroup, and then to Vancouver in about 97, I think. And I've been here, with the exception of LA, I've been for 2 years in LA. I've been here ever since.
And so why the LA skip out?
My wife, Miranda, was pursuing a career in television at the time and producing. Mm-hmm. So we got our visas and went down there. And she wanted to try her hand at that. And I'm like, great. I'd love to go to LA. You know, it's natural for me. So, she was on a non-renewable visa. And this was her visa ended 2009, just about the time that the whole economy tanked down there. And it was like, well, you know, I guess we could just get like hurriedly married, and I stayed on here on my visa, but she couldn't work. And it was like, well, really, I don't know. We love LA, but also going back to Vancouver is not such a bad option at that point. So,
right.
Yeah. I mean, things were pretty bad in the US when we were down there, just at that tail end. So,
yeah, that was a hard year, that 2009.
Yeah, it felt kind of uncertain. A lot of my work was, that's when my illustration work really started drying up at that point. I'd always wanted to do more of my personal work. I was sort of almost, my hand was forced, when the economy tanked, because the illustration work really dried up in a hurry, and it never bounced back.
Hmm. You know, that's actually funny. I've had so many people say, that they lost their jobs around then, so that they were, you know, like they were doing photography or they were doing design or whatever. And then they had their own art on the side, but they had day jobs. And then with all that stuff in 2009, so many people lost their jobs and they were sort of like, well, forced to do the big jump, and did it.
Yeah.
Thank you, recession.
That's interesting to hear. That's kind of comforting in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
It makes a lot of sense. I think like creative people always sort of have things on the side, right? That they're like, you know, crocheting or something or selling on Etsy. But yeah, I think that really, I guess, it makes sense that a lot of people were sort of forced into that transition. And I think for the better. I think, you know, that's a happy jump to make, although a really stressful one.
Yeah. But it's kind of cool to get your hand forced a little bit. Okay, so let's rewind for a second. So when you decided to leave interior design and pursue illustration, what did you go out looking for someone to rep you, or did you go around to all the ad agencies, or what did you do?
It was a really slow start. I guess I sort of like took the, you know, jumped ship on interior design around 1995. And, I think this is still pretty much pre-internet. So the resources were sort of slim. I didn't really know what to do. I didn't know a lot of illustrators, and I sort of just, I got a few gigs through, a design firm that was sharing space with the interior design firm that I worked with in Toronto. It was a graphic design firm that was sharing space with the interior design firm. I got a few illustration jobs. One of my first ones was like illustrating spot illustrations for like a Nike annual report.
Wow.
Like, well, there's nowhere to go but downhill from there. That was like, then I was, you know, it was like, oh, that was, I peaked, you know? and I was doing like a few things like menu illustrations and stuff, but you know, that client sort of didn't last too long. And I didn't really know where to go. So that's why I sort of did some tests for animation. And when I moved to Vancouver, sort of fell into animation as a sort of, I guess, a middle ground between illustration and that sort of practical, you know, way of making a living. So I'd always loved animation. I think the actual sort of grind of it is, it really takes the romance out of animation once you've been in it for a while, at least for me it did. It was a great way to make a living, and it was really sort of hopping when I moved to Vancouver. Well, it still is, I think, but hand-drawn stuff was really hopping in, you know, 97 to 2000. There was a lot of work. There was features that were being farmed into the studios that I was working for at the time, so there was sort of almost no shortage of work. But all this in the meantime, I was still like, you know, keeping sketchbooks and trying things out and reading comics by Seth and sort of discovering new things like Chris Ware's work and Daniel Clowes and Charles Burns. And also then sort of started to get into the illustration annuals and seeing people like Mark Ryden's work and the Clayton brothers and Martha Rich. And it was sort of all around that sort of time, was really opening me up to that. And then to jump forward, I guess, in terms of how I got into it, during a downturn in animation, I had some time to do some promo cards for my illustration work, which I had finally sort of got to a point that I was getting happy with the style that I was developing. And I sent them out to about two dozen design firms and illustration reps. And then that's how I came to be with Kate Larkworthy in illustration reps in New York.
Mm-hmm. You didn't phone them, though.
I didn't phone them. It was all the snail mail. Yeah, I totally snail mailed two dozen different people, different firms, and some magazines in there too and stuff. And
yeah,
just to get a feel of how things might go, or see if there was any interest for this style I was developing.
Wow! And so you got in with Kate Larkworthy.
Yeah,
and you're still with her.
Yes, still with her. Yeah.
Yeah.
She's been great to work with, and she was so supportive of me in the beginning, still is, but in the beginning in particular, she really helped to build my portfolio. She got me, you know, sort of off the ground professionally with various gigs. Had a great relationship ever since.
And so did that sort of allow you to leave animation behind then?
Again, it was sort of a transition of about a year and a half where I was in animation, but then sort of doing as much illustration work on the weekends as I could, or in the evenings. I mean, I was just working my ass off at that point, to get a foothold, in illustration. And then as soon as I got enough work in illustration, I was able to sort of like, leave the animation stuff behind.
Mm-hmm. And then what about personal work? So were you, I mean, when you're working your ass off like that, do you have time for personal work?
No, at the time I was only doing illustration, like editorial work.
Yeah.
So it was strictly editorial from about 1999 to about 2004. So a good 5 years there, just sort of like trying to get really good at just that, and just that portion of it. And then around 2004, that's when I sort of jumped back into sort of doing more personal work, some painting experiments, just trying different content that sort of spoke to me, I guess, personally.
Mm-hmm. Is that when all of your ladies started showing up? Or were they there already?
No, that's about right. Yeah, the pinup girls sort of showed up around 2005. So. Roughly around that time.
I love them so much.
Thanks. Well, when they started out, they were a lot more sort of like traditional, like very derivative of the 1950s. I was using photo reference as well, which is actually how I met Miranda, my wife. She was one of my models. For the first pinup show I had. Oh boy, is right. the work itself though was still very sort of, I don't know how I describe it, but sort of like Gil Elvgren and Petty and those kind of pinup artists, those traditional pinup artists. I was looking at a lot of their work back then. So I was really leaning heavily on both like pulp magazines from the 40s and 50s, and then also pinup art from that era. So, a lot of it ended up, you know, in hindsight, I sort of look at it now and it's like, oh, that was, you know, I'm happy with it, but it wasn't, I don't know, it in hindsight to me doesn't look that interesting because it's very derivative, I guess.
It didn't have your hand in there yet.
Yeah, it didn't have any sort of surreal touches to it, or maybe they were there, but sort of underlying, or, you know, but I think at that point I was just still trying to figure out how to paint and use color. I wasn't too worried, you know, at the time I was very happy with how they turned out. And of course, I think as most artists can attest to, it's really hard to look at old work.
Yes.
You know? that's the thing. One of the things that sucks about the internet is when you actually Google your own name, all the stuff that seems to come up is all so old and it's so painful.
I know. That happens to me too. And it's so embarrassing because I really, really don't like the old stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, when you started doing those, so 2005-ish, did you instantly get feedback, like good feedback that, like, you know, here we go?
I did. The first pinup show I did was, it was actually a local they're still open, local sort of like skate clothing store called El Cartel.
Mm-hmm.
And they were on Robson at the time. I think they're on Granville now. But they did sort of monthly art shows, and they were really like encouraging of sort of young artists and up and coming artists. So I did a sort of pinup show called Miss Universe, and it was like the sort of the nine planets plus the moon were sort of illustrated in pinup. So there was like a Saturna, there was Catgirls from Mars, there was that sort of thing. Each girl had sort of an attachment to a different planet, really original stuff. That was sort of the first, I made some good sales locally, and I was really encouraged by that. But also I had a couple pieces that didn't sell, and I contacted Rock the Rue Gallery in Seattle, and Kirsten Anderson took on those pieces as part of a group show. And that sort of started me off showing across the border, and most importantly to me, showing at Rock La Rue, which was like a huge gallery to me at the time, which just closed their doors, I think, a week or two ago.
Oh, no.
Yeah, she shut down the gallery to pursue other interests. But that was, again, Kirsten to me was like sort of the Kate of the gallery world, the Kate Larkridge of the gallery world. She really was an early champion of my work, and really stood behind my work and the evolution of my work too, as it sort of changed.
Were you nervous to reach out to her with those few pieces?
Not really nervous. Maybe I should have been at the time. But no, I just I thought, you know what, they're done. I'll just see where it goes. And she got back to me and wanted them as part of a group show. And I was like, just over the moon about that.
That's awesome. And were they, so a lot of those, I was surprised by how small those are. Were those ones small?
Ones were sort of maybe more like 11 by 17 sort of size.
Okay.
You know, be a little bit more square than that, but sort of kind of, yeah, a little bit larger, you know, 12 by 18. Maybe there was one that was sort of 18 by 24 kind of size. They're sort of not the small micro paintings I was talking about. Those ones were more sort of significant in size, I guess. Yeah.
And so the ones that I wrote about not that long ago, how big are those? Those are like, aren't they like six and a half by seven and a half or something?
Yeah, I'm thinking those are the mystery twins.
Yeah,
ones.
Yeah.
Yeah, so those are roughly five by, six and a half or something like that. Five by seven, I think.
And so those are vintage paper, right?
Yes.
And so where, first of all, where do I even begin? Where do you find that paper? And then also, does that dictate, you know, when you find something like a certain size that you like, does that sort of dictate a whole series?
Are
you looking for a specific size? Like, are you looking for smaller? Or like, if you'd found vintage paper that was big, would you have just gone with those?
Yeah, well, truthfully, the thing that dictated the size of those, the Mystery Twin series, was the cheap IKEA frames that I found. the Ribba frames I found that were like $3 each. And I'm like, yes, I can frame like 40 paintings for like $100. And
oh my God, I love that brutal honesty. That is hilarious.
Yeah, so, you know, people are, I guess, that they're digging deep into their psyche, or they're like, you know,
why, Ryan? Why the size? What does it mean?
What does it mean? So, yeah, no, those were sort of just, I wanted to do some small work like that, and I found these frames at IKEA, so that's that.
Where did you find the paper?
The paper comes from all over the place. I've had it sent to me from France. There was a customer that was cleaning out his barn in France, and he found this great atlas. It was like an old atlas, probably about 150 years old. Vancouver's not even on the map. It's New Westminster is the capital of BC on this map.
Wow!
In this atlas. This atlas is amazing. And I still got some paper left from it, but that's a lot of the work that I've been painting, gouache on paper, comes from that. The texture is incredible. First of all, this paper in France, it's not like new crappy paper that has a lot of acid in it, so it gets really brittle, or it breaks down, or it fades, or it ages. This stuff in France was like, I don't know what they use, but it's amazing. It's super supple. It's got sort of a slight pebbly texture that takes the paint really well. It's just, it's the most amazing paper. I'm trying to just drag it out as long as I can. And I save every scrap. If I'm resizing paper, I save every scrap so I can like Frankenstein it together one day when I'm like down to all these like strips of this paper. It's amazing. Wow. I also find stuff. I mean, I found stuff at my dad's like childhood farmhouse in Saskatchewan, these old textbooks that I ripped these like blank pages out. I found old ledger paper on eBay. I guess where it started though was my grandpa on my mom's side had a dry cleaning shop in the 1950s in Selkirk, Manitoba, and he had all this ledger paper in the garage. No one wanted it. I asked if I could have it. They're like, sure, our garage is like, you know, a disaster. Please take as much as you can carry. So I really started painting on that ledger paper from my grandpa. And what was really cool about, cool to me anyways, in the beginning is when I was using that paper, I would glue it down as a base for my acrylics. I would paint an acrylic over it. And when I applied the varnish for some reason sucked the ballpoint pen blue through to the surface. So these ghostly names would sort of start to appear from underneath the artwork.
Oh, that's cool.
Do you know how ballpoint pen, you can't really paint over it?
Yeah.
You know, if it's on a wall, it's like on a wall forever. It'll be bleeding through. That's sort of what happened with these early paintings that I was doing. So I kind of like that quality. It kind of added a ghostly sort of, you know, past life to these paintings that I was doing, which had a vintage feel to them anyways, so.
Yeah, and you know what I also love? I might sound crazy, actually, if I say this out loud, but the smell of old paper.
Oh, yeah, me too.
Oh, I love it. It just, you know, I get all these, like, flashes of being in my grandmother's house or whatever, and, you know, I've got all these old books in my studio, too, and I just sniff them every now and then.
Yeah, I sit around huffing old comics sometimes, for sure, and old magazines.
Well, it is. It's the ink and the quality of the paper and...
You can smell people's households in those. Like some of them smell fresh, and some of them smell really musty. And you can tell what brands people smoked based on like
certain
pulp magazines. Like it's amazing how those things retain the smell of people's homes. It's very weird.
It is, and it is cool though. It's like another kind of ghost in there.
Yeah. I think I really like that. I mean, that's something I really like about old comics and books is, you know, people sign their names to these things, and sometimes when I'm painting, I let people's names. Sort of, I work around people's names on these pieces of paper because I like that sort of past ownership to show through.
Yeah. Oh, that's so cool. I have a paper question. Does it ripple when you paint on it?
Again, this stuff is like miracle paper. I just did a big dinosaur painting that was like two of these big pieces glued together. It ended up being about, I think, 20 by 30 inches or something like that. Painted with gouache, so, you know, gouache is a water-based paint. Mm-hmm. Basically no rippling.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. It's just stiff enough that it doesn't ripple, but not too stiff that, you know, it's like cardboard.
Right. So. You're going to have to go to France.
I know. I'm going to have to go on a hunt for this old, I don't know. Like, honestly, this guy sent it to me for free. He threw in the postage and everything. If I had to buy these like Atlas sheets individually, like people sell these maps at print shops for like $100, you know,
painting
on the backs of these things. So,
well, if anybody in France is listening and your grandpa has a 150-year-old Atlas, send it to Ryan.
I will buy it.
He will buy it. There you go. You'd be surprised. Like the weirdest things come out of this podcast where people are like, actually, so you never know.
Yeah.
We might get you all paper supplied up for the rest of your life. That would be great.
That would be fantastic.
Okay, so I have certain paintings I want to ask about.
Sure.
Because there are some pretty weird narratives going on in some of those, and I love them. So, generally speaking, is there always like a story that you're trying to tell with each one that maybe the viewer's not going to end up knowing, but it's a personal thing, or like where are the stories coming from?
Yeah, that's a good question. Nothing is sort of really, I think, thought out that far in terms of like a real narrative or a real sort of like what's happening in this scene, what just happened, what's going to happen. But I do try to inject sort of, an element, I guess, of mystery that keeps you, that maybe wants you to answer that yourself.
Yeah.
I never want to really give too much away in my paintings. I don't want to be too direct or anything. I keep things sort of like, I guess whatever interests me is sort of what I respond to and what I sort of come up with that I respond to. I just sort of go with it. I don't think about it too much, and I don't think about the narrative too much. But if it's weird or it's like off, you know, or makes you ask questions, or I think that's what I really want to sort of achieve. So
mm-hmm. You do.
Okay, good.
Because they all kind of remind me of like a weird book cover or like a movie poster, and you're like, what is this thing going to be about?
Yeah, I think that's probably a product of like looking at old like pulp magazines and comics and stuff when I was a kid, that I didn't necessarily get to read the stories because the books were, the covers were like reproduced in a, you know, best of science fiction art or something like that, or books about comics. So they never had like the interior.
Right.
But they have these sort of enigmatic covers that like, what, you know, like,
yeah.
this amazing stories cover that I loved when I was a kid that was in this Making of Star Wars book from 1977. This is what really got me into pulps, was this amazing stories cover from 1926 of this giant globe, sort of magnetized globe, carrying this like ocean liner hovering over an alien planet with all these like naked winged women watching in the foreground, you know? And it's like, what? I don't know what, first of all, it's naked ladies. So that's
sure that you're already in, there's your entry point.
I'm in, but, but just the sort of the beauty and the mysterious quality of it, I think is something that sort of really grabbed me. And, that was the work of Frank R. Paul, who's a huge influence on me. And he's, I think really, it was a great sort of, master pulp artist and great at sort of drawing readers in with these sort of bizarre scenes and fantastic machinery and spacemen and aliens and all that kind of stuff. So,
oh, I love it. I would like to peek at your sketchbook, actually. I bet there's some weird stuff in there.
Yeah, I can send you some images from a little sketchbook I keep. That's
oh, I would love that. Every time I do a podcast, I do a great big post, and so I can throw, you know, some of your childhood stuff in there and this, and then people get the full picture. Okay,
yeah.
So the one I want to know about, the Bluebirds, 1970 Winnipeg. It's the two, there's a, she's got a jacket that says Bluebirds, and they're holding a dead bluebird.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on there? Is it about a sports team?
No, that was actually, there was I don't like to use the word fan, but a fan of my work I've been in contact with her. I can't remember why. She was interested in a piece or something, and her name is Rolanda Jackson, and I hope it's okay if I mentioned her name. I guess so.
We can always bleep it out if it's not.
Yeah. Anyways, there's nothing incriminating or anything like that. We're just like, oh, how many, can I mention names on the, but yeah, she had, I think she was like really into the sort of the girl gang thing I was doing and the sort of the mystery girls and all that kind of stuff. And she was telling me like via email, she used to have this sort of imagined girl gang in, you know, in her childhood, and it was called the Bluebirds. And that whole visual, just that sentence was like, that's, I have the painting in my head. I know what I want to, you know.
Yeah.
I think the Winnipeg 1970 clippings and that was sort of just embellishment that wasn't sort of directly related to what she had told me. But that was sort of my way of like setting it in a sort of in the past, in a sort of a, you know, an odd location, someone's backyard in this imagined like Winnipeg of 1970.
Yeah.
But that was sort of directly from like one sentence that someone had emailed me, and I just loved it. And I asked her, can I use that in a painting? And she's like, absolutely. And she ended up buying it.
Wow.
So she is the owner of Bluebirds, rightfully so. And on one of the Bluebirds, I don't know if you noticed, but there's a little sort of embroidered name on one of the Bluebirds that says Rolanda on it.
Oh, I didn't know this. So
yeah, that's the tribute to her and her idea. And
oh,
her
she must love it so much.
I think she's pretty stoked. She was pretty stoked to get it. I actually have it in hand right now. I have to do a little repair on it, a little piece of paint sort of flaked off when I varnished it. So she's got a really keen eye, so she noticed it. I'm like, don't worry, I'll fix that for you one day.
Well, it's such a beautiful one. Okay, and then the other one I want to know is about the the Red Beaver Bandit.
Red Beaver Bandit.
In Brandon.
I don't, you know, that one, I don't have, there's no no clients or fans that sent me anything about Red Beavers or Bandits. But I think that was just one of those things. Sometimes I just like odd like wordplay. Again, sort of using like I guess like slang, and that was part of my Romance of Canada show. So I was sort of, you know, trying to include not only sort of all this pulp lexicon that I do, but then also get a little bit of sort of Canadiana in there, I guess, and the inclusion of things like beavers and deer and you know, kind of weird Arctic fish or that sort of thing. So, that was, yeah, really no story behind that other than just the sort of, I just like the wordplay.
Yeah.
I think actually that name came from like an old radio show I was listening to, and the guys, what was the, it was a cops and robbers kind of like, you know, Calling All Cars, I think it was called or something. And it was about this, like this bandit. And his name, I think, was Harry Red Beaver. This was like in the 1930s. So I think this is like radio show. It's a half an hour long. I think they say Harry Red Beaver at least like 50 times throughout this radio show.
Oh my God.
And I'm like, okay, I have that image of the Beaver Bandit somewhere. So
I know. Isn't it awesome that my brain kind of works like that too? You hear something or you see something, and it's like you can instantly picture what the final piece should look like.
Yeah.
You just need those little snippets. See, this is what I love about your work is that whether you intend it or not, like you instantly start wanting to make stories, right? So I was picturing like, you know, you being 16 and madly in love with some red-haired girl that you were trying to sneak in your window or something. And so I had to ask. So now I know.
Yeah, no, this is nothing that cool or romantic or, you know, normal, I guess.
You could make that up.
Yeah, I could.
Yeah.
If I was smart, I would just run with that. But
her name was Rosie. I don't know. okay, so books. Let's talk about your books. How many are there?
Not that many, I don't think. I think there's maybe... counting the ABC book, I guess three sort of children's books, and then my Mean Girls comic, and then I guess...
Now, are those those are all personal works, right?
The two, actually, there was Monster Town and Robot Town are published through Henry Holt. So those were sort of more commercial projects through Kate
Larkin. Okay.
Yeah. The ABC book... that was a self-published book. That was also my first El Cartel show. The second one being the Miss Universe, but
right.
The first one being, the ABC, or was it the other way around? I can't remember now, but anyways, the ABC sort of, Halloween theme, was, an early show I had that I sort of had developed with the intent of doing a self-published book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the self-published book ended up being picked up by a local publisher, Simply Red, and that's how that sort of came about in its hardcover version.
Mm-hmm. And then the Mean Girls comic?
Mean Girls comic, again, was a self-published project from 2 years ago for an art show in Portland at Wieden Kennedy, and that was sort of the Mean Girls, the first sort of Mean Girls show or event, I guess, first and only, I guess, up to this point. But anyways, the comic was a big part of that, and published as a risograph and then picked up, later on by No Brow.
Wow. And so, did you say you're doing another one now?
That's the plan. Yeah.
Just
nailing down the plot, and we're sort of working out the schedule and that sort of thing. And I never like to make these sort of announcements ahead of time and jinx things, but I'm pretty confident about this one. And I'm also really gung-ho and sort of don't really mind getting the word out there to keep people's interest afloat.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it takes so long to do a book and to do a comic. And this is, like, I mean, the first comic, the No Brow, first Mean Girls was 24 pages. And the second one, we're aiming for like 68 to 70 pages.
Wow.
So it's going to be pretty time consuming. And I'm hoping that people don't lose interest by the time that it comes out, because publishing is incredibly slow.
I know.
Laborious. And, you know, doing a comic is going to take some time. So
Well, I'll do a big post.
Awesome.
You just tell me when you're ready to roll, and we'll do that.
Awesome. 2024.
Okay, sounds good. I'll be ready.
I'm gonna try and get this thing done while the poker's still hot in the strike while the iron's still hot.
Yeah.
So.
And then there's a poker and a fire in there.
Goes out. Yeah. So I'm trying to sort of get that underway along with these sort of commissions that I'm working on. But I'm very stoked about this project and pretty passionate about the Mean Girls project in general. So I really want to keep that as a sort of an entity. Keep mm-hmm. that afloat.
Oh, I can't wait. It's all so good. Did I just hear Roxy come home?
No, that was probably my squeaky office chair.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Because I was just like, oh, they're back. Okay. Well, you know what?
Not to move too much. My office chair is a real squeaker, so.
Me too. Listen.
Yeah.
I sit here motionless during the record. Yeah. Okay. I got to get comfortable there. Let it squeak once. Okay. The only thing left is the not so speedy speed round.
Okay. Sure.
Okay. Ready? This is a Manitoba question.
Am I supposed to answer these in really brief answers? Because I tend to babble on a little bit.
When I first started the podcast, I think you're like episode 68 or something. The theory was the speed round was going to be speedy, but it never is. It always just ends up being like these long conversations, and it's always my fault because then I ask follow-ups. Okay. So that's why I now call it the not so speedy speed round.
Got it. Okay, good. I just want to play by the rules.
Yeah, fair enough. Have you ever gone to a social in Miami?
No.
Really?
No.
Miami, Manitoba?
Oh, okay. well, still no.
Oh, really?
You're talking about Miami, like what is I've never been to Miami, Florida, so.
Have you been to a social?
I've been to a social, but in Winnipeg, not in Miami, Manitoba. But yeah, social seem to be sort of an oddly Manitoban ritual, I guess.
I think they're only Manitoba.
What's that?
I think it's an only Manitoba thing.
Seems like it. No one else I talk to seems to know about things. That's where you basically, that's where you always have your first sort of underage drink and your first underage cigarette and your first, whatever you're underage, that's where you do it because there's nobody there checking.
No, I know.
Usually nobody knows who you are because you just buy a ticket from somebody that.
Yeah. For somebody's wedding and you don't even know who's getting married, but you show up because there's booze.
Exactly.
Yeah. When I first got to Morden, so I was going to UVic and my parents had moved to Morden. And so you're forced then to go home for Christmas and whatever. So I just go to where their house was. So their house was now in Morden and I'd been there for a couple of days and somebody said, we're going to a social. And I was like, I don't know what that means, but I'll go. And they're like, yeah, it's in Miami. And I was like, holy shit. Like, and they're like, do you want to go? And I'm like, yeah, like we're going to Miami. Like what is happening? I was thinking, I think I was 20. And, so I was like, I'm in, how are we getting to Miami? They're like, oh, we're going to drive. I'm like, it's the middle of winter in Manitoba and we're driving to Miami on Saturday night. Like I'm not piecing this together. The conversation went on for a very long time before I realized that Miami was a teeny little town with basically two barns and we were going to go and drink in one of them. And so I thought, I wonder if you had ever been to a social in Miami as well.
That must have been a huge disappointment for you.
It was shockingly disappointing, but then actually a really fun night.
When you accepted it, the fact that you're not going to Florida and you're just going to go to a barn like 5 miles down the road. Then
yeah,
in
minus 40 weather, snow, that ain't Miami. But you know what? There was like $2 highball. So I was
there. Yeah. They're always $2.
They're always $2. I know. Okay. See, that was the first question in the not so speedy speed round.
Yeah, man,
oh my God. Okay. Let's just skip along then. Favorite food. This should be quick.
Favorite food. Oh man. I'm just going to go with Mexican. I'm just the first thing that comes into my mind, but you know, like anything like authentic tacos, I think are probably my favorite. You know, carnitas,
You must have loved your time in LA.
Yeah, definitely. We did, we did indulge in some Mexican food down there for sure. Thai food is also a favorite of mine. You know, Thai, Mexican, probably a close call on that one.
Yeah. I wouldn't do a fusion, though. That wouldn't probably work at all. Okay. Worst summer job you ever had?
Worst summer job I ever had.
Or if you had an awesome summer job, you can tell me that. But worst ones are always better.
Pretty mediocre summer jobs in Winnipeg, I got to say. There was nothing that really stood out to me. I don't know. House painting was actually kind of cool because I was, you know, outside. But at the same time, it's sort of like, I don't know. It was...
Was that what you did most summers?
That was what I did, I think, a couple summers.
Yeah.
I worked at the local grocery store, too, when I was sort of younger. I wish I had a more interesting sort of job for this answer, but I really don't. I feel it's very Manitoban. It's sort of like everything's very middle of the road. There's nothing that interesting. There's nothing that terrible. It's sort of like everything is just there, you know?
Yeah. My summer job in Manitoba was the same.
Mediocre. I don't know.
Yeah. I worked at a golf course restaurant in Manitoba and then a dress shop. Same. See, just kind of.
Yeah. Nothing to speak of.
Nope. All right. Moving on. Well, actually, I had another question, but I'm going to ask you. Have you ever been to Corn and Apple Festival?
No.
What?
That at the beginning of the podcast, that was the first time I'd ever heard it. Actually, I don't.
No.
Yeah. No. That I've never. Yeah, I mean, maybe I heard it before, and just it kind of went one in one ear and out the other. But
well, I guess you were one of those big city folk in Winnipeg.
I guess.
Corn and Apple is this, it still happens, this big party weekend thing in Morden. And people would come from all over the place for Corn and Apple. And I thought, oh, I wonder if he's ever been to it. Everybody I know that lives in Manitoba knows about Corn and Apple. So after you go to France and get more atlases, you got to swing on through.
Yeah, that's really awful. I've never experienced this Corn and Apple Festival.
It's something.
I feel like...
There was a lot of $2 drinks there, too.
Did they have, like, corn liquor and apple, like, Applejack or something? Like,
well, there was family-friendly activities where you eat a lot of corn and apples. And I think there's a parade and blah, blah, blah. But then there's the big, you know, $2 drink dance at the Elks Hall or whatever. And it was always quite fun.
Oh, man.
I know. Okay, your wife and baby are probably about to walk in any minute. And... But thank you so much. I know your life is a bit crazy at the moment, and I'm so glad that we were able to do this.
Absolutely. Thank you, Danielle. I really appreciate it. It was more fun and less stressful than I expected.
Yep, that's always a thing, right? It's just nice to chat. And then next time I'm in Vancouver, it's like we already know each other, and we can go grab a coffee or something.
Absolutely, yeah. I don't know how often you get into town, but... For sure.
I'm there actually quite a bit. So I'm going to be there this fall sometime. So when I know, I will give you a shout.
We will catch up.
Okay. Sounds good. Thank you so much for doing this.
All right. Thanks again.
Okay. Bye.
All right, take care. Bye.
Squeaky chairs, mean girls, and lots of Canadiana. That was very fun. Ryan's work is just so gorgeous, so well done. And I love finding out there's such an amazing guy behind all of it. Okay, now, if you happen to have any 150-year-old French atlases, let me know, and I will connect you with Ryan, because it sounds like he's going to need one very soon. Thank you so much to Ryan for taking time out of his very busy, new dad, art-making life. Thanks to Saatchi Art for supporting this episode. Thanks to Audible for offering up a free book via audibletrial.com/jealouscurator. And of course, thank you for listening. There will be more Art for Your Ear next weekend. See you then.